I can hold my beer as good as any man, and I'll dance and sing as long as I can.
Welcome to Rhythm and Brews, the monthly podcast where we perfectly pair beer and music.
You changed it back.
Yeah, see, I've gone back to the original. It's not as good as craftily combined.
Did you say musically matched last time?
I think I said musically matched. I can't remember. I didn't have time to come up with an alliteration, but it's okay. But anyway, so we're back for episode 7. It's very exciting.
It is.
The fact that, again, people are still listening. It's always nice. And
we wouldn't care even if they were.
No. So we're back with Luke and Andrew, and this month we're basically bowing down at the moment.
Yes,
because we've got
a very worthy,
very special guest here in Mr. Pete Brown.
Hello.
It's a great intro.
Can I just say, suggest rhythmically roped together?
Oh. See, Robert from Orbit came up with Atmosphere. Last time, which was to describe the whole concept.
It was the beer, new beer lexicon that we're just slowly building. Yep. Beer and music lexicon. Pete Brown, before we get into this...
Oh, I got to explain this.
You're going to have to jump in here and correct Andrew. Andrew, do you want to explain the concept for anybody who hasn't listened to this before?
Okay, the theory being that you can enhance flavours through other senses, yeah? So notably sound. And so the concept being that you can play certain sounds that enhance certain tastes. And so for bitterness in a beer, for example, you can enhance it through bass tones. And for sweetness in a beer, you can enhance it through higher pitch tones. And if you really want to go for a sour, it's the kind of spiky, discordant kind of tune that should enhance the sourness of a beer. With the combination that in some shape or form, you are making that beer taste better. I'm saying you want to aim to make the beer taste better.
I say you just want to enhance some of the flavours. You know, it's because, you can have a beer that might benefit from being a little more spiky and undrinkable.
No.
I'm thinking something like, see, we're killing him already. I'm thinking something like, Wild Beers, Smoke and Barrels, the summer one. The one that was just one of the most challenging beers I've ever drunk. That I just wanted to pick something that really fucked it up, some kind of like discordant atonal sea shanty. Anyway,
there's plenty out there. But I'm going to expand it a little bit because I think there's another layer to this. So there's the purely neurological, the tones that then have an effect on the taste. But I think everyone has experiential psychological interpretations of music. Music
Definitely.
Is just not a set of tones. It's a backstory for a lot of people, or you're going to try and tell the backstory when you play it. So that comes together as well. So if you want to play a warm, snuggly tune for a dark, wintry beer, that works, I think, on one level. It's great if you can then have the bassy tones in there for the bitterness and the darkness. I'm going to expand this out and say there's two streams to this.
Oh, definitely. I think I'd agree. It's basically creating an experience around the beer.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I've explored both. I do this kind of thing in a live show, which started off as a bit of fun with me standing at the front of a room with an iPod linked up to an amp, playing my favourite songs and tasting my favourite beers. I was having fun, that's all that mattered.
Yeah.
And I did it once at the Edinburgh Science Festival. It was part of a broader food and drink event at which a guy called Professor Charles Spence from Oxford University was also doing a little thing, a little gig. And he's the guy who's in the UK really pushing all the stuff about the neuroscience.
Okay.
He's been experimenting with all sorts of stuff. He's done a lot of stuff with Heston Blumenthal. When you read stories about meals being served with conch shells with little mini iPads inside them. iPad mini
iPads. To play seagulls.
So that's all Charles's work.
Yeah.
And it's all about screwing with your senses. And the first time he saw me matching some of my favourite songs to my favourite beers, he said, "You do realise there's a scientific basis to this." And so I started looking at that, and I was doing a show at Bristol Bristol Food Connections, which is organised by the BBC, or sort of inspired by the BBC. And they still told me that as part of the thing they were doing, Tony Hall, the Director General of the BBC, was coming to see my bit of music matching show. And I thought, Tony Hall cannot come along and see me playing New Order tracks to IPAs. And so I just kind of went away and wrote a proper 90-minute stage show.
Wow.
With lots of video, lots of visuals, lots of research. And it was quite shonky, and thankfully Tony Hall only stayed for 5 minutes. I can't see the shonky bits, but I've practiced it again and again since then. And Charles Spence came to it after I thought I perfected it, and he said, "You do realise you lost all the humour and charm that you used to have when you were doing it." I was like, "Oh, man, I can't win." Basically, what came out of that is, there's the way our brains are wired.
Yeah.
Which is your first point. But the other point is that, I mean, I think the conclusion I come to is that that stuff can be overridden by the intensity of your personal experiences.
Yeah.
So before you start even combining them, your perception of flavour, your perception of sound is influenced by your entire life's experience. Yeah. You know, Marcel Proust with his Madeleine.
Yes.
You know, he gets this. When you read that passage, I've not read Proust. Everyone pretends they have. but I've read that passage. When you read it, it tastes this cake. And this enormous sense of well-being comes over him before he can match the memory where it's coming from.
Okay, yeah.
So the emotion comes first with the flavour. Okay. And it takes him a little while to go, why do I feel this incredible sense of well-being? And then he remembers the aunt or the grandma that used to feed him his cakes. So the emotion is quicker than the thought.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. Yeah, when you... Some of my favourite music, the first time I hear it, it makes me nostalgic for times that I've never experienced. it creates a feeling that's so strong. Yeah. You go, oh, that reminds me of... Well,
it doesn't.
I just feel like I've known it all my life.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that's really interesting. Because I was going to say, because it sort of does play in synesthesia, but synesthesia isn't about those emotions and memories.
Well, I got onto that.
Okay.
I think everyone's a little bit synesthetic.
Yeah,
so little is understood about synesthesia.
Yeah.
And I've done quite a lot of research on that as part of this show, and I finish off with a little kind of flirtation with synesthesia. But the thing is, there's a lot of conflicting research on it at the moment.
Right. Yeah.
So I've read some research that says... So the most popular form is kind of letters have different colours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's say A is red and E is blue and so on. And I read some research that says, the thing is, everybody who's synesthetic with colours and letters, they all think that red is A and E is blue.
Oh, wow, that's freaky.
And then also, if you get people who aren't synesthetic...
Yeah.
And you do research that says,
if you had to choose a colour.
This is obviously ridiculous, but if you really, really had to choose a colour, and you'd get the same patterns.
Wow.
You get people, A is red. So I've read that research. I've also read research that completely refutes that.
Okay.
So we don't know. The exciting thing is that things like this are absolutely on the forefront of neuroscientific research.
Yeah.
It's a very new discipline. The technology about brain scanning and that shows which parts of your brain light up and respond to different stimuli is about 10 years old. And so what we're doing now is actually proper scientific research.
That's awesome.
Oh, I knew we weren't just dicking around.
Exactly. We're going to get an honorary professorship at some point, right?
That's from Oxford University.
That's
Charles Spence, easy man.
That's what I'm waiting for. Brilliant. Okay, so how did you get in? So obviously, you're not only known for this whole beer and music matching, you're also... you've written a couple of books.
Yep.
On here. You've now written, what is it? It's
my eighth book is coming out in 4 weeks.
Wow.
And so far, 7 of those have been about beer. It's directly about beer, is it?
I'd say the one coming out is the fourth one that's actually totally about beer.
Yeah.
I've had a couple that are about pubs.
Yeah, right. Obviously.
One that's about cider and one that's about apples.
Yeah, okay.
So we're in the same area.
Yeah.
In terms of solidly writing about beer, this will be the fourth.
But your background is not... You didn't go into a writing degree or anything. You're in advertising, weren't you?
Yeah, my connection with beer actually started... Well, my professional connection with beer started 20 years ago this week when I started work at an advertising agency as the strategic planner responsible for Stella Artois and Heineken.
Okay.
That was 20 years ago this week. And that was good times. And when I... started work. By this time, I'd worked on newspapers, butter, or yellow fats, as the advertising industry tries to
like white goods.
Yeah. I worked on the launch of Blockbuster Video in the UK. I worked on the launch of Tropicana Orange Juice in the UK. And when I started working on beer, there was just a connection. But it wasn't just the kind of. I wanted to work on. The reason I started working in advertising, because in the 80s when I was growing up, the beer ads were the funniest things on television.
Yeah.
You only had four channels, yeah. Two of them had adverts on. And if there was a funny beer ad from Heineken or Carling, about half the population saw it. And we went to school the next day. And the catchphrases from beer ads were our comedy catchphrases.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I found myself, you know, in 1997 actually curating, handling some of those great campaigns. And ruining them, really.
You could mention those campaigns to loads of people and it would just click with them straight away.
Yeah, I mean, we had. I was responsible for looking at the campaign slogan, Heineken refreshes the parts that other beers cannot reach, and saying, should we carry on using it or should we ditch it for something else? And what no one had remembered, no one realised was, but by this time it actually hadn't been used for about 8 years.
But
people but still thought,
what it was.
Yeah. And so it was more a case of, shall we bring it back or not? And my research concluded that we shouldn't. And then I got this reputation as the man who killed the most famous advertising slogan.
Even though it had not been
So really, it was the fact that you had to get out of advertising.
Partly it was that. My writing career coincidentally started around that time. But the thing is, I wanted a book that was that would give me. There were lots of books from sort of the first generation of beer writers that would, and people are still writing these books, where you get a chapter on the history of beer, you get a chapter on how beer is made, and then you get an encyclopedia of beers, either arranged by beer style or by country, and it's all the good beers, you know, it's all the nice good beers that we're all supposed to like. And I was working on Stella and Heineken, thinking, okay, I'm not defending those beers as good beers, but I'm reading books that tell me they're a comprehensive guide to beer. And they don't even mention them.
Right.
Like, you know, mention them and tell me they're shit and tell me why they're shit.
Yeah, exactly.
But don't pretend that 90% of the market doesn't even exist. Yeah. So also they were tasting notes and there were nothing else. And my interest in beer was always the cultural aspects of beer. I sat in focus groups watching beer drinkers, and you know, this was the age of Britpop and lad culture, and you got all these lads coming in going with their gelled hair and their Stonewashed jeans, and they're like, I'm not going to kind of give my cool away, I'm going to kind of sit here and take the piss and be superior to this particular group. And within 10 minutes they were leaning forward passionately discussing their favourite beer brands and what they liked about them. And
yeah.
And I thought, I've not seen guys this passionate about anything else other than maybe their football teams.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I couldn't find anything to read about the culture of beer and the culture of pubs and that kind of thing. And so eventually I decided to write the book that I wanted to read, and that was it. And when that book came out, I quit my advertising job and
haven't looked
gradually
back.
Yeah. Well, I have many times.
Yeah, unfortunately, advertising pays really well. That's the
yeah. There was a period where I was meeting, you know, the guys I trained up who were by this time running agencies, and they all stayed really skinny with sharp haircuts and expensive suits, and I got fatter and shabbier.
Who's happier?
We would meet up at kind of. There's a phase where people kind of having their 40th birthdays, and you know, my former trainees were now MDs of agencies, and I'd see them across the room and they'd be all kind of like really sharp and slim and stuff, and I'd walk over to them, and as you got closer you could see that their eyes were red and their skin was grey. and they were like, we're so jealous of you and what you've done. I'm like, yes, but I earn a tenth of what you do now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but you're happy. Yeah. You're having a good time.
That's exactly it. So, I mean, so obviously that was... So the first book was Man Walks Into a Pub, wasn't it? Which is fantastic, by the way. I'm not going to climb up your arse often tonight. But yeah, and so since then you've just basically been sort of exploring the social, culture, history, like that side of beer, right? And obviously now cider and apples.
Yeah, this is what I love about beer, is that beer is all pervasive. It's the biggest drink in the world, apart from tea, coffee and water. It's on sale in most countries around the world, over 200 different countries. Mm-hmm. It's been a mainstay of civilization since about 8,000 BC. So if you want to write about beer, you can write about history, you can write about science, you can write about politics, you can write about culture, you can write about sociology. Yeah. You can take beer as your lens, and you can write about anything you want. So I've written travel books, I've written books of personal discovery, I've written social history books. My new one is a science book, but they're all about beer. Yeah. So that's what it's an inexhaustible subject. It really is.
Yeah, and so the music aspect, which you obviously touched on. I mean, how did you originally get on that? Like,
well, I always wanted to be a music writer. I wanted to, you know,
not a musician, a music writer.
Yeah, and the thing is, I did what most people who want to be writers do. I kind of listened to bands and waited for NME to call me up and say, oh, we've heard you're some kind of undiscovered genius. And surprisingly, they never did.
I'm still waiting. To be
yeah,
honest.
Same.
And then, never happened to Tony Parsons. Yes.
And then my wife started this literary festival in Stoke Newington in 2010. And we started to kind of mix in more literary. So there's a lot of kind of writers and stuff living in Stoke Newington. We got to know them all. And I met a couple of music writers, people who had been my idols. I completely freaked out Simon Reynolds at a Litfest event by getting him to sign the page of the book that I was reading that he'd written. The page of the book I was reading when I realised I wanted to be a writer.
Wow.
And he signed it and ran away really quickly. There's a guy called Andrew Harrison who ran Select magazine for a long time. He was editor of Q.
Okay.
He was one of the founding people of the Word magazine. And we went to the pub and he was saying to me, beer now is music in 1979. It's year zero. Everything's okay, to play
yeah,
for.
Yeah.
And he was saying, as a music journalist all his life, he was saying, music journalism is dead. I wish I was in your shoes. And that really shocked me, because I wanted to be a beer writer all my life. Sorry, I wanted to be a music writer all my life.
Yeah.
And here was a music writer I worshipped, jealous of me being a beer writer. And I thought, well, but the more we talked, the more the similarities yeah, between beer and music came out. And so at our literary festival in year three, which was 2012... I thought I would just do a beer and music matching event. Wow. Partly as a piss take of beer and food matching.
Not that I think
beer and food matching is ridiculous in any way. I write about it and I think it's good, but I just wanted to kind of mess around with concepts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it got written up by a couple of people on blogs and they said, this is really interesting.
Yeah,
so
it is.
I thought, oh, there's something in it, definitely.
I mean, for me personally, music is synonymous with drinking. It doesn't have to be beer, but yeah.
Well,
whether you're at a gig, you're at a festival, you've normally got something in your hand, or you're about to go and get something.
Beer or dark fruit cider, exactly. It's, or a nice snake bite. Well, I mean, because so that's the thing. So I'm sure you're probably aware, but this whole thing was actually born out of Andrew seeing you do one of your beer and music matching at Green Man.
Green Man last year.
Green Man,
Which was fantastic. First time I've been to Green Man. The best beer selection of any festival I've ever
been
to. It's absolutely amazing. And then I saw you were doing this and thought, that's got to be interesting. And it's free beer.
So, not much free beer, but...
No, enough. And then, I mean, you had a whole tent of people taking it absolutely seriously. I mean, that's the aim. You're telling people, I can make you taste this different by playing this.
That is one of the most extraordinary gigs I do. This year will be the fifth year that I've done beer and music matching at Green Man, and the first year we did it, I think 10 people came, and the second year we did it on a Sunday afternoon, and Green Man has a beer tent which has got 60 local Welsh beers and 30 local Welsh ciders.
Fantastic.
And so it's quite easy to match different beers with the bands playing the festival, and the second year we did it, I was in on the Sunday afternoon and all the beer had gone.
So
I was doing it with the standard pouring lager at the standard. And then the third year we did it and about 40 people came. And then the last 2 years, it just kind of turned into this extraordinary thing. And the tent seats about 900 people and it fills up. And it's just incredible. And I had some people come along to me afterwards last year and said, oh, we come to this every year. And it's a nice thing because now we do it at 12 o'clock on the Friday at Green Man. And it kicks off the festival.
Yeah.
And it's great because all the beers are still there.
Yeah.
I can do my gig and then relax and enjoy the festival. And these people said, oh, it's our tradition. We come to this as our way of starting the festival.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, that means you've heard my jokes 3 times. they said, yeah, it's part of the fun for us. You know, we kind of sing along with the punchlines. So I've just written a new joke for this year's thing, just for those people.
You should come. So disappointed I'm going to miss it. No,
it's a great lineup this year.
I know. It's looking fantastic. That's a problem. Too many good festivals out there.
Yeah.
Can you just go to all of them? I've got a really neat little indie pop one in Norway that you can come across to.
And so
I suppose you kind of touched on it there with the whole, this got bigger in the last 2 years. Do you think that coincides with this whole sort of craft beer revolution?
I think so. I think people are interested in tasting different things now. And also there's, I always think of that, it's not quite the same thing. I always think of that old Bob Monkhouse joke where he said, people used to laugh at me when I said I wanted to be a comedian. They're not laughing now. but people used to laugh at me when I said I was a beer writer. They found that really amusing. And I can remember when Hops and Glory, my third book, won Beer Writer of the Year, I had both friends and relatives say, you're obviously quite good at this. Have you ever thought about writing a proper book? And there was just this idea, until about 2010, 2012, there was this idea that beer just wasn't a subject worthy of serious discussion or examination.
Yeah.
And that's completely gone now. I tell people I'm a professional beer writer now and they go, cool, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So there has been this whole, you know, the craft beer thing has gone mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, my mum knows who Brewdog are and has an opinion on their antics. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's really gone mainstream. And I, for the most part, think that that is a great thing.
It is, but I think it's not just craft beer. I think it's just benefited beer. People are just looking for beer they like and thinking about it when they drink it a bit more as opposed to just swallowing it.
Yeah.
You know, there's cask, keg, whatever you want to drink, it benefits everyone.
Yeah. It's interesting, you just said for the most part. I mean, you know, because we probably want to get on to drinking some beer at some point, but, do you have any worries for the sort of future of the beer industry or where it's going?
Well, I think it's a very fraught time.
All of the mustachioed hipsters that are coming in, or...?
I think it's a fraught time at the moment. I also think people are kind of looking for signs of trouble on the horizon.
Yeah.
There was an appallingly researched article in The Guardian over Easter weekend saying the craft beer boom was over. And when you read it, it was just rubbish. You know, saying, oh, so last year we saw 500 new breweries open, but already there's about 10 that have gone to the wall. And it's like, have you any idea of the average success rate in any business sector?
Restaurants, startups.
If you're seriously telling me that, you know, craft beer has got like a 95% success rate for startups, then that does not mean that the boom is over, you know. But what was surprising about that was that the number of brewers and beer pundits who retweeted this or shared on social media, yes, look, it's over, I told you it was, come on, get back to being miserable now. Because people don't quite know what to do with all this success and this. And I think I always write about craft beer being several different things at once. It's a movement for the people who are involved in it, which they care very passionately about. And like any movement, it's about politics, it's about stance, it's about identity and self-definition. And for those people, it's deeply troubling when you get something like Camden Town selling to Brewdog. So Camden Town selling to ABI.
Yeah.
It's also a hipster fashion thing. There's no getting away from that.
Yeah.
Some people are drinking it because it's trendy.
Yep. Yeah.
Fair play to them. And to a lot of people, it's just good beer. To a lot of people, my wife and her friends, who started drinking this kind of stuff under sufferance, they now drink it when I'm not there.
Even in the short history that we've been doing this, I mean, I've got a wife that starts off saying, I don't drink beer, I don't like beer, it tastes of beer, I don't like it. And I'll do beers for the podcast, or I've got cupboards full of beer at home at the moment, and every time I open one, I think, oh, she might like this, have a taste of that. So that's really nice.
Yeah,
that's really nice. And my hit rate on the beers is, she's having to reassess the whole statement of, I don't drink beer, I don't like beer.
Well, this is the thing. I think this is one of the brilliant things about craft beer booming at the moment is it's the range of styles that are coming out, that are sort of coming back, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Where it was, having a same thing. My wife, she's a lot more... she's a lot more wary about the whole beer thing, but she's... I managed to get her to drink a whole glass of Ninkasi because it wasn't a typical beer taste, and the wine had run out. But she was saying, she said, I wasn't planning on enjoying this, but I actually quite like this. Now when I try and put it in front of her, she claims beer is bad. But you know. Can't win them all. So, you know, slowly. But it is, I think it's great that all of these styles are actually broadening people's tastes as well, which is good. Okay, so we're going to get onto the beer.
Right.
Okay. Does this sound good?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
so
yes.
Let's move on to beer number one.
Beer number one.
So maybe we should explain. So normally me and Luke do the beers and choose. So we've been very generous. And let you have two of the beers while we normally we get to just pontificate in front of guests and say this is what we thought.
Yeah,
what
you're you, the what you, first guest who has been able to actually
I'm honoured
I mean, because you know, we don't want to leave this to amateur hands. I mean, that would just be dangerous. Let's listen to our first two episodes. So beer number one is this is Mike Hess Brewing,
yep,
of San Diego,
yep,
with 8 West, and I believe I picked this one actually, which is a it's an orange honey wheat beer.
Yeah,
right. You've got some more on it there.
No,
if you
can I read out the website blurb to set the scene?
Jeez, go ahead.
No, I like the stuff that breweries write to try and convey what it is you're supposed to be tasting. Some of it's complete.
Yeah, I know you do, because you're boring.
Okay. Named for the highway to the sun-kissed Pacific shores of San Diego, 8 West is brewed with local orange peel and more than £2 per barrel of pure Californian orange blossom honey, resulting in a smooth, crisp taste that embodies America's finest city. And I think they mean San Diego by that.
America's finest city, New York. So yeah, what's your opinion? So you only had a good snifter of this
just last night.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one for me because I don't drink a lot of wheat beer, and at the same time I'm also on a tip of being really getting quite frustrated with people chucking the herb and spice cabinet into beers. my new book is about hops, barley, yeast and water.
Yep.
And I'm not a purist in any sense of the word, but in writing that book I've rediscovered the brilliance and the miraculousness of those four basic ingredients.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we're not doing enough with them. I did the first Stoke Newton Beer Festival in January, and lovely guys who organised it. It was actually a fantastic festival, but I wanted to pick four beers that did each of the four basic ingredients. Okay. And there were none.
Everyone's got an adjunct. Else. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So get a wheat beer. It's like, oh, it's a wheat beer. And it's got orange peel and honey in it. Oh, my God. And these are exactly the kind of beers that in the wrong hands are very dangerous. But if you know what you're doing with flavour, yeah, as these guys do, then it's a real treat. And, you know, the first sniff of it, the first taste of it is summer. I think wheat beers are always rural. In my head, they're always sunshine. When I pair straight wheat beers, I use Neil Young's Harvest Moon, and it's all about late August with the harvest and haystacks and barn dances and stolen kisses behind the back of the barn and that kind of stuff. This one isn't like that because it's got these extra dimensions with the honey and the orange, and it makes it lighter and sunnier for me. So, and then I read that blurb and it's San Diego and the coastal highway, and so I was immediately, you know, on the west coast overlooking, yep, the Pacific, the sun high in the sky, and that led me completely to the Beach Boys.
Of course. So you know, straight in there. So should we listen and then we can discuss how this, well, should we pour some more, Andrew,
pour some more,
and then we can discuss how it would be good. So shall I introduce it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a song that nobody really knows. So this is the Beach Boys with Wouldn't It Be Nice.
Make it that much better when we can say goodnight and stay.
That was Beach Boys with Wouldn't It Be Nice.
I'm feeling tanned.
It's the glow of the halogens in this this small room. I can see that. I think that's very much experience, the experience based, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There are some. It's 75% experience based. There are some neuroscientific cross-modal perception elements within it. There's a big with the wheat and especially with the honey. That's quite a sweet beer, not in a bad way. But when you're looking through the kind of matching those the basic tastes with different audio characteristics, close vocal harmonies for me are always sweet. Sweetness is melodic and high pitched. So when you get close vocal harmonies, that just does it for me. Close vocal harmonies and a 12-string semi-acoustic guitar in any shape or form do just nail sweetness for me.
Ah, see, look,
we're using all this.
He's done way more. We're never going to release this episode. We're going to mine it for gold. Yes, I'm just yes. A plus would do again.
I mean, because to me, there's very little bitterness in that. That's just a nice. Lovely drinkable beer.
It's very rare. An American beer that's not massively hoppy.
I know. Yeah. We've been having this with recent beers that we've been picking. We've been going for, you know, so pales because it's like, you know, oh, well, we've got a lot of dark sort of malty beers. Let's give something that, you know, will kick us in the face with some hops. And it seems like it's going out of fashion if you're not drinking in a Weatherspoons. But it's...
nothing wrong with spoons.
Nothing wrong with spoons. Thanks for sponsoring. I wish. I think that brought that out very nicely. It was, and I can see you're right. I mean, from a tonal perspective, that matches the beer quite well. But I mean, also as we were saying during it, it's like that is the quintessential stick it on. As soon as you can open the windows, as soon as you can open the doors, and it's like summer has arrived.
Yeah, yeah. And wheat beer is a summer drink for me. And the other thing is it's a very outdoors drink. There's a thing that I do with contrasting, if you like, beer and music matching terroir. You know, when you get this kind of relaxed, open, sort of outdoorsy music, and you put wheat beer with it, it feels like neither the music nor the beer could have come from a sort of gritty northern industrial city. And I always counterpoint it with Joy Division, Unknown Pleasures, which was recorded in Strawberry Studios in Stockport, which is home to Robinson's Brewery, who make Old Tom. And I could describe both Old Tom and Unknown Pleasures as dark, brooding, mysterious, jagged, heavy, complex. And you wouldn't have got Old Tom or Unknown Pleasures on a highway in California.
It says a lot about Stockport, doesn't it?
If the recording studio was in, you know, the beautiful Cornwall coast, it wouldn't have
been the same.
Sounded like that. No. It wouldn't have tasted like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I suppose it's the whole, you know, you can't really enjoy a nice oyster stout whilst listening to a summery pop band at a music festival. It's, definitely. Okay.
I'm going to give a shout out because we talked about Stockport. I'm going to shout out to Helen again, who's one of our best listeners in Stockport.
Excellent.
So I'm going to give Stockport a mention and Helen's. And don't edit it out this time.
I'll try not to. Every single time Andrew goes off script, it's just like straight away, edit it out on the cutting room floor. It's okay. I'll just release an outtakes episode at some point. It's fine.
So I was drinking that and trying to hold it up to the sunshine, which is...
Just the halogen lights again. Does wonders. Okay, well, shall we move on?
Mm-hmm.
Shall we move on to beer number two?
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to do this one next?
Beer number two.
Oh, so beer number two is Beaver Town's Smog Rocket Smoked Porter.
Okay, let's grab them. Let's get them poured out.
There you go.
Okay, so do you want to start reading your...
Well,
you've probably got your blurb and everything.
I have. I've got a whole page of notes, dude.
Of course you do.
Look.
Of course you do. Look at that. On real paper.
Because I do. Okay, so I am going to read out how Beavertown described this. Because it is important to me.
Okay. It's all about your narrative, right?
Yeah, inspired by London's Industrial Revolution when smog filled the air and the porter was the beer of the people. an original homebrew recipe using 9 different malts, including a good chunk of smoked Rauchmalt. Is that how you pronounce it? You're the German scholar.
Rauchmalt.
So smoked malt from Bamberg, Germany. Big flavour hits of molasses, raisins and caramel are cut with a resinous US hop Chinook. Smoky aromas fly, reminiscent of the smokestacks of industrial London.
Okay. Your tasting notes?
My tasting notes. I'm going to crack it open. I'm going to pour a bit out.
Dead air.
And
for
then,
every podcast.
And then
notes.
I'm going to say, so I read that description. I looked at the can. It says Smog Rocket. It says it's a smoke porter. I smelt it, and there's no smoke in this for me. It's just not... It's not smoky. Not nearly as smoky as I thought it should have been based on that description, that can, that name.
I think you need to get your nose checked.
No.
I think the thing is, if there's one sort of slightly grating aspect of craft beer, it's that the tasting notes always have to be big and awesome. and I think there's a lovely subtle smoky edge on that.
Okay.
But I think if you're Beaver Town, you're not allowed to say there's a lovely subtle smoky edge.
No,
it's got to be big. It's got to be strong. It's got to be. And that's not the criticism of Beaver Town, it's the language of the entire category. The older I get, and I'm getting very old now, I love nuance and balance and sort of complexity and sophistication. And we're not quite there yet with mainstream craft beer, where it's like, no, it's got to be punchy, it's got to be awesome, it's got to be loud.
They've chosen to highlight a characteristic in the name of the beer that you don't expect. I mean, I've got a whiskey at home that's a blend that's called Peat Monster, and you open it up and you've got a bonfire in your face, and that's exactly what I was expecting. And I was expecting something vaguely similar with that. Really, really smoky, you know, almost bacony type smoke in your face.
I definitely got that kind of meatiness on the nose.
I was just about to say the same thing. I definitely have got that meatiness. It's the smoke. It's smoked goods.
I mean, it's a nice porter. I like dark beers anyway, and so, you know, it's got the sweetness in it. It's got the darkness, the smoothness, a little bit of bitterness on the back of the tongue. But I enjoy drinking that. I'd already started concocting what I was going to be choosing based on the description and the name, and then I had to go,
jump the shark.
Yeah. But then I thought, we played jazz last time round, and I can't, so we couldn't pick jazz again.
Yeah.
We can't have jazz 2 months in a row.
Oh, is that right?
No, no one can have jazz.
No. And we can't keep picking Tom Waits, so Tom Waits is out.
Yeah, Tom Waits is working. Tom Waits is working.
So this is the bit that Luke hates, where I do my notes and I say, this is what I was going to play.
So this is the part of the podcast where basically I can just put a little bit of bed music underneath where Andrew just lists off a bunch of bands.
That he nearly picked.
It's very, very good. This is the point where anybody can go for a wee if you need to.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on.
So I've already primed you for this. Okay, so I'm off to see Bill Callahan tomorrow at Hoxton Hall. Who, aka Smog. So I nearly chose him just because I'm off to see him tomorrow, and he's an awesome guy.
And you're literal.
But he's got a really deep, sonorous type of voice to me, and so that would have worked with this. So I nearly chose it. What else was I toying with? Some sort of supper time club sort of smoky vocal type thing to try and bring out smokiness. So I was looking at Julie London because it's a London porter.
Oh,
you see what I did there?
Yay. Yeah. Literal, seriously.
It's worth exploring.
All it does is
sometimes literal delivers the goods.
Yeah, but that was just fortuitous. Her name's London.
Okay.
That, you know, Fly Me to the Moon, Cry Me a River, that would have worked.
Sure.
Smoky, dark.
Yeah, I agree, but you didn't pick it, so it's fine.
So I didn't pick it, so you know what I picked. So I then thought, London bands, this is supposed to be a London beer, synonymous with London. I'll start fishing around in some London bands and see if I can find something that matches this, yeah? So I toyed around, you think of the Kinks. Kinks aren't right for this beer. But I then latched on a guy whose vocals, you know, I think match this drink really well. The song I've picked has got a saxophone predominant all the way through it. I always think of saxophones as being a smoky instrument. If you're going to highlight the smokiness, let's have a saxophone in the song.
Sure.
And
a bit of woodwind.
Despite the fact he mentions lager in this song, ignore that reference.
Okay.
We're drinking a porter. I went for something by Ian Dury, and the song's called That's Enough of That.
Okay, so let's do this. Ian Dury with That's Enough of That, and stick around for us rubbishing it afterwards.
The postman, letters in his sack. Dear Auntie Mary, we'd love to have you back. Here come the letters through the letterbox. Poor Georgina, it's caught the chicken pox. Here come the cornflakes, here comes the milk. Read the morning paper, watch the Kilroy silk. Here comes a toothbrush, here comes a shit. Here comes a number 15. Oh, bollocks, I missed it. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. Here comes a journey, bus and train and foot. Crowded conditions, watch your foot where you put. Here comes the office, here comes the job. Get your bloody head down, shut your bloody gob. Here comes the evening, here comes a pub. Sink a pair of lagers, eat a bit of pub grub. Here comes a disco, here comes a piss. Here comes a holiday in San Francisco. Here comes another 23 years of this. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. That's enough of that.
Andrew, there was only two swears in it, and they were modest swears.
They were modest swears, especially for Ian Dury. Actually, that's,
yeah. I was saying we could have, I could have picked Plaster Patricia, which has got a lot of swearing at the front of that song.
What, purely for the whole point of having swearing?
Actually, if you ever listen to it, yes, basically, it's just... All right, but 10 seconds of swears.
Never more. Okay, so now we're into the section where we tear down Andrea's choice.
Okay, but so I'm going to start. I think this is a lovely, smooth, dark beer, and I think everyone else in the room is in disagreement with me.
I wouldn't say it's...
smooth.
I wouldn't say it's particularly harsh. I'd say it's strong and it's smoky, and it's really complex.
I mean, you say strong, it's less alcoholic than the Mike Hess. This is 5.4.
Yeah, see, this does not taste like a 5.4. It's this tastes like something that would be dangerous on a night out.
It tastes stronger, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. And I was just saying that whilst that was playing, especially during the final sax solo, that was bringing out the sweetness of the beer more.
Trickle toffee in this to me.
I can get the molasses, definitely. But more on the burnt end than the...
It is. It's not a hot bitterness in this. It's a burnt... Roasted bitterness in this.
I think that's what gives it that urban kind of sort of sleazy chic, really. I think that it was a good pairing for me because we're sitting in an office in rapidly gentrifying East London.
Yes, yes.
But that took me to a place with pubs with overflowing ashtrays.
We're off to the Blind Beggar later, so you can't get more East London.
It just felt like right at home. You know, you could always imagine it was a kind of, you could imagine him playing in a pub like that with this beer, sitting drinking it with this beer. I thought it was a very good atmospheric match.
Yeah. So the other one I nearly flipped a coin over was the Pogues and Dirty Old Town.
Okay, yeah, which was similar kind of atmosphere, right? Yeah, but a lot dirtier in tone. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
That's the problem with Ian Dury. It's like his voice, I quite find quite often, does not match the music that he pairs it with. Where it's, if you just gave an Ian Dury instrumental, would sound like elevator music, like that song.
Yeah, so the sax on its own.
Yeah.
With
this, you know, like geezer.
Yeah, Landon.
That's it. His voice to me is the main pairing element here. Hmm. Yeah. With this beer, I'm sure.
Definitely.
That's what you're thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Chose it.
So, go on.
You've done this before.
Oh, yes. This is the killer question.
So clearly, you went for a very different
song.
Song?
I went for a much more obvious song.
Okay.
When I do my show, I'm covering the whole sort of gamut of all the different flavours and all the different ways it can work, and so it's probably in kind of broader brush strokes than when you sort of do it on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Setting myself up here for something. But I pair this with Hendrix doing All Along the Watchtower.
Okay.
And I do that as part of a pair of beers and tunes, which I'll reveal later when we taste my final beer.
Okay.
But this one, it is, and it's very similar. It's coming from the same place as their as Beaver Town's tasting notes. You know, for me, it's heavy and industrial.
Industrial.
Okay. There's that. There are various different origin stories for the term heavy metal. But one of them is an American music journalist saying Hendrix's guitar was the sound of heavy metal falling from the sky. And it's been disputed. You know, that is one of three candidates, I think,
for the term
heavy metal. But that, for me, is what this sounds like. And for me, when you listen to Along the Watchtower, my favourite bit of that has always been that bit where the guitar just kind of swoops in like a dive bomber. And then just kind of comes back out with his little trills on it, and that for me is the heart of that match.
Okay. See, I mean, it's stylistically, it's not massively removed. I prefer your choice, though, Pete.
That's because you're a kiss ass.
That's because I'm a kiss ass. I'm crawling up the.
You said you weren't going to do it.
The backside. I know. It's okay. I'll edit the second, third, and fourth times out. It's fine. Okay. So, well, with that, shall we move on to beer number three?
Yes.
Number 3.
Okay, so beer number three is Buxton Brewery's Axe Edge IPA. So this is another one for you, Pete.
Yeah, I'm glad you chose this one. Buxton have been around for quite a while now, in craft beer terms. And it's easy to forget them when you're... And it's also easy to forget that London was not the birthplace of craft beer. That a lot of these exciting breweries were were opening in the north of England before they were opening in London. As someone from the north of England, it's very important to me.
So to keep emphasising
that. Makes sense. That. Rent is much cheaper in the north. So, yes. Yeah. It's,
yeah. And I've not tasted their beers for a long time, and I'm getting really fucking bored of pointless pale ales and IPAs, where some breweries opened because they think it's an exciting thing to do, and they've phoned up and got a load of Citra hops or a load of Mosaic hops, and they've made a pale ale which has no point or purpose to it, and it's just a kind of canvas with some hops shat onto it, and there's too many of those now, and when I tasted this again last night, it was like, oh yes, oh that's nice. Hoppy American style IPAs were my, and as I'm sure for many of the 13 million British people who now claim to drink craft beer, these kind of hoppy IPAs were the revelation. They were the gateway into craft beer, because you taste something like this for the first time
and you think, wow,
and you think, I've never tasted anything like that before, that's incredible. And this has got that, and I think the people who are all into their hop excess, you still need balance. I think you could have an incredibly hoppy beer that is still balanced, because you just chuck a load of big malt backbone into there to give the hops something to riff off. And that's what this beer is doing. There's a shitload of hops in this beer, but it's still balanced because there's still that kind of backbone for it to play off. It's a really sophisticated, well-made beer, and if I was tasting it blind, I would say it was definitely American West Coast.
It does. It tastes like a West Coast. So they got a blend of European, North American, and New Zealand hops, which is not something that you come across very often. It's usually, you said, it's basically, they just take whatever America is growing and chuck as much of that in as possible. I mean, I love it because it hides all manner of sins when I'm brewing at home. It's interesting actually, because it's a really nice, well balanced beer.
I like balance in a beer, and that is balanced.
Yeah, it's got resiny hops. It's floral. It's definitely a hop bomb, but there's more to it than that, which is just wonderful.
It's got it on the nose, but not like you say. Maybe it's the malt that's balancing it out. So I'm getting bitterness, but not ridiculous. And I'm getting the fruit on the nose.
Well, it's not. Yeah, it's not the. Trying to think of a good example. Devil's backyard bone.
Backbone. What, that one. The spoons one.
Devil's backbone.
Yeah.
That is a perfect example of the kind of beer where they've just kind of gone, hey, we'll make a sparkling water and then throw some hops in it.
Yes.
It's a completely characterless beer apart from the amount of hops that they've thrown in.
Yeah. Anyone can do that. When I first started cooking, I'm quite a passionate home cook. And my centre of my repertoire is curry, and I've learned to cook curry from some really expert Indian chefs. And when I first started making curry, I thought if I put twice as much chilli into my curry as the recipe said, I was being a really sophisticated Indian cook.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. I was being a dick.
Remember this, Luke, when we brew beer. Remember this.
And I've since learned that, you know, if you go down somewhere like Borough Market and you get a chutney stall where an Indian housewife has been making these chutneys for years.
Yeah.
And now her kids, who are really business savvy, have turned into a business.
Yeah.
And you taste some of this red hot, the hottest one they've got, you taste it on a bit of cracker. The first thing you get is sweetness, not heat.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, this is nice. And there's kind of deep red fruitness to it. And then the heat starts, and the heat builds and builds and builds. And after about 30 seconds, your mouth is burning.
Yeah.
That's quite a beautiful progression.
Oh, yeah.
When you taste a similar thing that's been poorly made, you put it in your mouth and instantly there's this flash of chilli heat and there's nothing else. And that's the thing that I'm now looking for with hoppy beers. I love hoppy beers the same way I love really hot curries. But I want that blend. You want it to be tasting, you want your mouth to be kind of coated with hot resin by the end of the glass, not on your first sip.
Well, definitely when I'm drinking beer, I'm in my mind doing this progression from the front of the tongue to the back of my tongue, and I'm picking up the sweetness, and then I'm getting the bitterness at the back and the edges of my tongue, and that to me is how I visualise this.
Yeah, and there is a journey.
Yeah, yeah, journey across my mouth, and that's not a porn film.
give it 2 weeks, I'll make it. Well, it's interesting because I've only recently discovered a beer. So I took a trip out to Australia about a month ago, which has one of the most ridiculous craft beer scenes in the. You go into any good, decent bottle shop and you look for the craft beers and you have to, like, fastidiously check the labels to make sure that it wasn't made by one of the major breweries. But stumbled upon Stone and Wood and their Pacific Ale, which was, to me, it was the first time that I'd actually tasted a beautiful IPA that was, like, just... It had the perfect balance. And I put that also down to the hops that they use, because that's the thing. It's like IPAs don't use Pacific hops. They use Citra. And
exactly.
If they're wanting to be a bit rebellious, they might use a bit of Amarillo. But it was a bit of a revelation. But you're right. I mean, that seems to be what happens these days.
Yeah, yeah. It's a phase, and we will go through it. But I spent 10 days with the guys from Stone and Wood last year as part of my book research, which is just... That's why I got the best job in the world. But we picked some Galaxy hops in Tasmania, and then I had to take them on a plane up to Byron Bay, where Stone and Wood's brewery is. Which is like, if you got a good answer, say, okay, paint me a picture of a microbrewery on a deserted desert island. They would paint you a picture of the original Stone Wood brewery. It's like everything's sweating with condensation, and there's kind of palm trees everywhere, and wooden shacks and stuff. And they designed Pacific Ale. There's the beach hotel in Byron, which is where all the surfers come up, and it's one of those that you've got ice encrusted pumps, and it's kind of semi open. There's just umbrellas to protect you from the sun. And they said, well, when we're here... So the brewers at Stone and Wood go surfing in the morning before they go to work, you know.
Yeah.
And they said, when you're coming up off the beach with your surfboard at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and the sand is clinging to your feet and the seawater's drying on your legs and you come up to this bar and it's 35 degrees, what is the beer you want to drink at that moment? And they designed Pacific Ale to be that beer.
And you know what? I think it is. It was funny, actually, because I had my first Pacific Ale in the UK recently, and it tasted wrong.
Doesn't taste the same, does it?
It was drizzling outside.
There you go, it's situation.
I was on Exmouth Market in London. It was just... I was drinking it, and I was closing my eyes because I'm like, please, take me back.
But that's the thing it's important to say when you're doing all this kind of stuff, and maybe you've said it in previous editions, but we've all done that thing where the drink that you adore on holiday, you wrap a few bottles up in your suitcase, and it's raining and it's grey, and you think, oh, I was an idiot, it doesn't taste nice at all because now I've got it home, it's shit. And you weren't an idiot.
The situation changed
the flavour of it and enhanced the flavour of it.
That's it. I've got at least three bottles of limoncello for that exact reason.
There's nothing wrong with limoncello.
So on to the music that you were going for with this, because I completely took you off track there, Pete.
I've gone back to my first ever beer and music match that I did. The first time I decided to do this at the Stoke Minted Literature Festival, I matched a hoppy IPA with New Order's Your Silent Face. New Order are my favourite band of all time. It gets to a certain point with a band that you've loved for decades where, because they were your favourite band, they're present at every significant event in your life. They're on the soundtrack. They're the soundtrack to your life.
Yep.
Did you have them at your wedding? Come on, first dance.
It wasn't the first dance. It was about the third dance. But this, in the same way that hoppy IPAs changed my life when I first tasted them, hearing this album by New Order when I was 14 changed my musical life. I said earlier something about how sometimes... music can make you nostalgic for memories that you've never had and for places you've never been. And the first time I heard this album, I thought, I know this music. And I didn't, but it's like, but this music feels like it's inside me. It feels like it's been there forever. And this particular track feels like that every time I hear it. And so when I first paired them, it's like, it's my favourite song and it's my favourite beer. And that was as far as it went. But there's a lot more to it than that now. And what I try and do when I'm pairing IPAs is everyone talks about the bitterness of IPAs. And as you've said and as you've explored before, bitterness is kind of low, sonorous bass. Mm. But then sweetness is kind of high-pitched and melodious and stuff. And IPAs are sweet as well as bitter.
Yeah.
And people don't talk about the sweetness of IPAs. We talk about the fruitiness of the hops. But we don't think, well, actually, there's sweetness and there's bitterness. Yeah. And a song like this with the synths, there's points in this song where there's the deep resonous bass in the synths, and there's points with beautiful high notes that, that pick out the sweetness of the hops, I think.
Okay, so with no further ado...
I know this is going to work already.
Here we go.
I know this is working.
This is New Order with Your Silent Face.
Thank you.
your silent face, which, you know what?
Are we recording now?
We've been recording the entire time. It's okay.
Okay.
But I'm very gassy right now. That brought me out. It wasn't anything about the beer. That brought me out, that song. Mm. It was, you know, that was emotional and spiritual.
I'm so pleased.
But on a beer note, I don't know. I barely noticed I was drinking it.
It's gone very quickly, hasn't it?
It was
this 6.8% IPA seems to have just evaporated.
So yeah, it was. I mean, I think that was perfect kind of matching for that. That was. It's funny actually because we're talking about Beach Boys being summer. To me, New Order and that whole era to me is also slightly summery.
Yeah, it's a bit different, but the same things.
Maybe it's because
autumn. It's got to be raining.
Summers of my youth were me trying to be emo. So
I've got to be wearing my long student coat, and it's got to be raining. And for me to,
it's always been my fascination with. I was a dyed-in-the-wool indie kid through the 80s and most of the 90s, and the fascination for me in it is with New Order, the Smiths. In particular, he got taken the piss out because it was so fucking miserable. You know? And you listen to Morris's lyrics and they're hilarious. You listen to Mars' guitar parts and they're incredibly uplifting. And that song is kind of big and synthy and ponderous, but some of those synth chords, they just make you feel alive.
They're joyous.
You
know, there's a joyousness to it.
There was that to me, that feels like the kind of church that I wish existed.
There is a joyousness. There's a celebration in there. You can take that song in one of two ways. You can be let down by it because it has that sense to it, but you can be uplifted by it. It's completely uplifting.
And this is something that I wish we could tell to the electronic music makers of today, where to make something uplifting, you don't need to just put in all these high tones going. Weirdly, I went into Darude's Sandstorm, it feels like cavernous warehouses where everybody starts to feel it's the coming up on questionable chemicals.
It's a very personal experience in your own space, and you're just uplifted by it. You feel it, you see it.
And like I said, having had the benefit of being in love with that song for 34 years now. me and my best mate Chris from when we were 9, you know, from about the age of 14, 15, we both loved New Order. And we've had so many adventures together. And I guess recently, you know, about 18 months ago, I was doing my new book on pubs and I was trying to get to pubs all around the country. We spent a weekend driving around the whole of North Yorkshire, Lake District and Lancashire, kind of checking out a massive long list of pubs. And that's the kind of song we're putting in the car.
Yeah.
And we've got this together as friends. We've got this 40-year history, and together as friends with that song, we've got a 35-year history. And you just put that song on, and we're just, you know, we might not see each other for 8-9 months at a time, no. And then it's like, here we are, we've got our song on again, and you can just put the bromance. It's just.
I want to see that filmed. Forget the trip with Coogan and Bryden. Stuff Alanis
Pete Morris, Brown and his mate.
When I wrote Three Sheets, I was before I knew how to write travel writing proper. Well, I'm assuming that I do now know how to write travel writing proper.
you are Beers Bill Bryson, right?
So absolutely. I mean, when I got that quote, I followed that for all it was worth. But when I submitted the first draft of Three Sheets to the Wind, and some of the trips I went on for that, I did with my wife Liz, and some of them I did with my mate Chris, and I just wrote up stuff as it happened. And my first draft, my editor came back saying, I think the idea of the character of Chris is very interesting, you should develop him more, but the character of Liz isn't really working, you should maybe cut her out. Like, yeah, I might have a problem with that, because this is real life. And so Chris was just crowing about that. He hasn't stopped crowing about it, really. And Liz is just like, well, no, that's not going to happen.
That's the only very brave man actually told her. Okay, well, should we move on to the final beer?
Yes, what is the final beer?
Oh, okay, well, wait.
Oh, it's yours.
Yeah, here we go, here we go.
Beer number 4.
Which is Oh, geez, I'm not looking forward to this. Any Belgians, I apologise for the pronunciation.
So no, you have it nailed.
Beer number four is a Chimay, which is a Trappist ale.
Yes, it
and
is.
And it's Chimay Bleu. Grand Reserve, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Yeah. Which is obviously because they've got a whole range of the Trappists. And
they
do. This is the this is the nice one.
No, there's one up from this.
There is.
There's like the 11. You go up to 11.
Yeah.
With the Trappists.
This beer was one of the biggest lessons I've had in my sort of appreciation of beer. You get to the Belgian beers and they're like, oh, this is amazing. There's so many different flavours and stuff. And then you get pulled away by the lure of American hops into IPAs and stuff. And back when I used to have money, I used to get quite a lot of beer and shove it in my... I'm lucky enough to live in a house with a cellar.
That's okay. Just not fair.
There's obviously a dreadful thing, which is my wife... used to be quite...
Your wife's not dreadful.
She used to be quite severely asthmatic, and we live in this Victorian terraced house which had a bare earth floor cellar.
Yeah, okay.
And every time it rained, she would end up in hospital because all the damp spores would just aggravate.
Oh, yeah.
And so we had to basically spend a lot of money getting the cellar tanked.
Yeah.
And a happy kind of sort of byproduct. Obviously, the main thing about that is that my wife no longer goes to hospital when it rains, and that's the important lesson. However, once the cellar had been tanked, it was beautiful and clean and had enough height down there, because I dug it out a bit more, enough height to run a bunch of IKEA Ivar shelving all down one side
exactly.
of it, which is, and it just happens to be perfect cellar temperature. So I
wow.
So I had all these beers down there. And
wow.
About 5 years ago, I was cooking a meal for friends for New Year's Eve, and I was making a carbonade, which requires a nice sort of dark Belgian beer to go in it. And I went down to the cellar and I was pushing bottles aside, and I found these two bottles of Chimay Bleu that were about 3 years out of their best before date, covered in dust.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, this is a carbonate. I'll just taste one of them just to make sure it's not vinegar. And I tasted this beer and it was just... You know, if you ever in film, it's that bit where they were that kind of crash soon. And I tasted this beer. It was just like I was standing there with my mouth open, just going, "Ah!" It was the most perfect beer moment, and I very gently wiped off the bottles and went, "That's not going in the fucking stew. That's being served alongside the stew." And ever since then, whenever I get distracted by anything else in beer, Belgian beers bring you back and bring you home. And there's still nothing in the world that's as good as Belgian Trappist beers. It's the finesse of them. It's there's a tradition and there's the know-how. And you can get excited by bold, new, adventurous beers. And you come back to a beer like this and it's just like, yeah, but it's just got everything. It's just there. This Duvel, Orval, Westmalle Double... they're just the classics. No one else can make beers as good as this.
I think the thing is that this is the kind of beer that nobody fucks with. Like this
we've been doing this for 150 years. Fuck off.
Yeah, can you imagine? Can you imagine like some hipster beer company going, "Yeah, we're going to revolutionise doubles and triples"? It's never going to happen. But it is because these. You're right. These do have the nuance and the complexity, and it's the so I think probably my first introduction to any beer that wasn't 2 is New or 4X or VB was probably at a Belgian beer cafe back in Sydney, which was like a beer that is 13%. This is crazy. I must have it. But that was the first different kind of beer that I tasted, and it was my senses were shocked when it first came out in this crazy chalice.
Yeah.
Beer isn't drunk from a chalice.
It's always a chalice. You have to picture a chalice in your mind, otherwise you're not doing it right.
Who calls it a chalice? Anyway, but it is. It's a different class. It's almost. It doesn't deserve to be called. Well, I don't know. I don't want to be sacrilegious here, but it's almost like it isn't beer. It's its own thing completely.
Yeah, it's so far off, and I've only recently dug a bit more into the history. The difficulty with, obviously, sort of Belgium is that they insist on writing their history in sort of Dutch or French.
And Flemish, don't forget Flemish.
Flemish, not Dutch. which I can't read. And so I've only just got into it. And you get this incredible story around the time that, you know, in the 1880s is when you get yeast kind of isolated and put into laboratory conditions and easily replicated for the first time. So all these big global brands that have got establishment dates on their labels, you know, Heineken, all these other beers, it's all kind of 1870-something or 1880-something, because that was the first time that you could kind of say, okay, we've isolated single-strain yeast cells, yeah. We can now replicate them exactly, time after time after time. So the thing about a brand is, you know, if you're buying a bottle of Heineken, whether you like it or not, it has to taste the same as the last bottle of Heineken.
Yeah.
And before the 1880s, beer wasn't like that, and afterwards it was. But only if you had the money to invest in the lab equipment.
Right.
Yeah.
And so around the 1900s, the Belgians saw the way it was going, and they saw that the big Dutch brewers like Heineken and Amstel, the big English brewers like Whitbread, were investing in all this new equipment and producing these cleaner, more consistent beers.
Yeah.
And Belgium went, well, our brewing industry is mainly rural. We can't invest in that equipment, so we're screwed. Unless we embrace what we have and take it in a different direction. And so led by it wasn't just the Trappist brewers, but the Trappist brewers led this, and it's, you know, you think these things go back centuries, and yeah, they've been brewing for centuries, but the whole idea of Belgian beers like this only goes back to about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
When the Trappists led this charge to say, this is the way that mainstream beer's going, we're going to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
Which is all about bigger, richer flavours, using wild yeast, mixed fermentation. And it's just the most incredible story.
Thank goodness.
I love the way it went.
Well, and it's funny because when people think Belgian beers, they think this style, right? They think they think the Trappist ales, whereas, you know, all of the trendy beers of the moment, so your farmhouse ales are Belgian in origin. All your Saisons are they Belgian?
Yeah, absolutely.
Saisons are Belgian.
Yeah.
And pretty much all of your sours as well are Belgian in origin. It's like, it's the mecca of beer, and it should be seen as such, which I suppose it is.
Yeah, it's not trending, it's not fashionable, but I think when you get over the trending and the fashionable, you come back to Belgian beer. And it's quite funny, because when you talk to Belgian beer nerds, the people who've never moved away from the faith, you talk to them and like, oh yeah, well, Chimay, that's like the big commercial one, and Chimay Blue, that's not even a proper Trappist beer because it's so ubiquitous. And you get to thinking that, going, oh yeah, I've got to chase that elusive bottle of Westvleteren 12.
Of course you do.
Of course you do.
And
then,
you have
then
to.
You taste a bottle of Chimay Blue by accident, as I did, and you go, actually, my God.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, actually, because the only one that's really made it out to Australia is Duvel.
Yeah.
Which we kind of see as this crazy European beer. Nobody in Australia understands the history of it and the fact that it is still brewed by monks. It's like, it's not a commercial. Well, I'm not sure about Duvel. Is Duvel
not brewed by monks anymore?
I'm talking out my ass now.
It's very much of that style.
Yeah, but yeah, it's.
Trappist's got to be monks. You've got to hand over the money to... You can't be seen to be making a profit.
But you know what the problem is? I mean, the monks in Belgium, they brew this.
Yep.
Monks in England...
What are they doing?
Buckfast.
What are they doing?
That's what they're doing.
Why?
They're
brewing Buckfast. Some of them are doing wine.
Ampleforth Abbey now brews beer. Good Belgian-style beers.
There we go. Okay, good.
Maybe they're going to get a designation as a Trappist. Before we leave Europe,
I think they're probably working on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall I get onto my tasting notes? So I've gone for the full gamut here. Paul's dark amber with a nice foamy head. Now, so I mean that's the thing.
Yeah, but that's a pale head. Look at that.
Oh, totally. But this hit me straight away. This is.
Do you get bananas in this?
Quintessential.
Am I the only one that's getting bananas off this?
Yes.
Foam bananas.
This is like quintessential strong Trappist ale, right? This is what Belgian beer is. It has a bit of prickling carbonation, just for you, Andrew.
Just a little bit. I like
just
that
for
phrase.
You. Smooth, dark, has some high tones about it. It's got the. This is something that I'm really struggling with, because we've had a couple of saisons, and it's all I can explain it is it's got high tones. That's literally it.
Do you mean spicy?
We were talking about this. I think it's the spiciness, which doesn't mean the same when we're talking about food,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's the spiciness. Also, I'm just going to say,
you know, you're drinking alcohol with this.
Yeah.
Monks clearly know how to party. Like, seriously. I know that they don't drink this shit, but, like, they like to watch a good party.
They must drink it.
Like, apparently they don't.
No, they brew they brew Chimay Gold, which is 4.3%, and that's the one that they...
Okay.
That's there the one go. That they drink.
Yeah.
Right, okay. That kind
of okay.
They brew this one to sell... To raise money for good works.
Yeah. That is one of the requirements of a Trappist beer.
On a bit of a side note, it's like Buckfast, the monastery that brewed Buckfast has become a bit of a pilgrimage point for nice, honest Glaswegians. And apparently the monks are just getting really pissed off with the fact that they've just got pissed up Scots in their abbey coming down to drink Buckfast.
I'm so glad that that's happening for them.
That's anyway, it's this is basically like thick, chewy, molasses, like, but there's not that kind of sickly sickly sweetness. I'm four beers in, clearly.
It's definitely smoother than... I get what you're saying... Compared to the Beaver Town, this is a lot smoother.
This is leather. This is like mahogany.
Compared to like, what your corduroy.
This is the Anchorman of beers. Now, so music wise, for some reason, straight away, as soon as I tasted this, I was like French chanteuse, which is like,
that's very interesting.
It was a
Brel. Why didn't you choose Brel?
I don't know. I should have gone Brel because he was at least Belgian. But it was just a sort of feeling that I went down. Saying low, bass, heavy, but actually I kind of veered away from that because I basically spent about an hour playing French chanteuse songs.
That's just your life.
Ended up smoking a packet of cigarettes and
wearing a striped
talking
top.
Talking French, wearing
nothing.
Yeah, it was great. But I ended up stumbling upon. So I did not do research into what you'd picked because I knew you had picked something. And I ended up now knowing what you picked. I ended up in psychedelic rock.
Cool.
Which was interesting. So I chanced upon this tune that I think it's not so psychedelic. So as I don't know if I said this on mic or not, but I kind of felt like after half a glass of this that I was tripping balls. It's because it is fucking strong, and I was hallucinating.
It's 9%. Let's say
it feels way more than that.
Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. There's something wrong here. Anyway, so Chimay Bleu mixed with a little bit of weed would make this song the most perfect thing in the world.
I'm intrigued.
But I'm going to play it. This is a band called St. John Green, which I can go into a bit of the history
of
them.
You need to, because I haven't heard of them.
I'll do it after the song. But this is their song, Goddess of Death.
Walked into the cold silence, being careful not to step on those who had passed out there in previous times, or the rotted bones of those who could never return. And I ask, why are we here?
That was John Green with Goddess of Death. So a bit of backstory to that. So this is a random psychedelic band who kind of started to get really popular from just doing gigs, signed to a big label, released one album. They hated it. The producer, who was a real hotshot young guy who was doing all of the big psych rock bands of the day, still believes that even though it's definitely not his most commercial, it is definitely his best work that he ever produced, but it caused the band to split up.
I expect that to be in the soundtrack for some 60s reefer induced film or a club scene in a 60s film.
I want it in a 60s horror porn film.
Vincent Price, that's what it is.
So I'm just going to.
Where a straight has been just kind of led off the.
Definitely.
And there's a whole thing going on, yeah.
So I'm going to give my what I think that does, which may just ruin your entire view.
I'm enjoying this beer anyway. Whatever you said.
Ruin my trip.
Well, that's the thing, is it's meditative. I reckon it rounds the beer out. It smooths out the harsh tones to it. I think it makes it smoother, the highness of it.
I don't think it's meditative. That's not meditative.
Whatever. I listen to metal. And drinking it within the allotted 2 minutes and 20 seconds will probably have you seeing visions. That's the thing. I doubt so. I had probably 3/4 of a glass left in my taster session, and I listened to that and downed it within the 2 minutes and 20 seconds. That's probably why I felt it was a very strong beer.
So I think I've gone to Belgian beer, away from Belgian beer, back to Belgian beer, away from beer. So we have a very good local bottle shop to us, and they have lots of UK British beers, you know, cutting edge, and they have a shelf of Germans, Belgian beers. I look at them and I think, no, I've had those, I know what they're like, I'm going to go over here.
Well, when you've
except
got, you
I
know,
think I need to be picking those bottles up, because you know, I've done the Belgian trip, I've been to Bruges, I've done all that. But this is.
But when you've got that standing next to a Cloudwater V13, I mean, that's. But it's fine. So, bringing it back to the serious business at hand here.
I wasn't serious.
I then did look up what you did with this. Or it wasn't the Chimay Blue, it was the Chimay Red?
No, it was Chimay Blue. Chimay Blue is my ideal beer. Sometimes I can't get my hands on it, I sometimes have to do something else.
Okay. So. Yeah, so explain what you did, because...
Well, this is there's an interesting connection here with what you've chosen. So I pair this beer, Chimay Bleu, with Debussy's Clair de Lune, which is my favourite piece of classical music. And my initial pairing between the two is all about... This is a dark beer that has layers and depth, but it's smooth, it's unctuous, it's vinous in a way.
It is.
And it's classical and it's elegant. And when you get the rolling piano part in Clair de Lune, it's quite magical. And that for me is what goes together. Now, the interesting thing is that Debussy was synesthetic. At a time before anyone knew what synesthesia was. But Debussy used to see sound as colour.
Okay.
And he would compose his symphonies in blue. He would compose his symphonies in the colour blue, and we're drinking Chimay Bleu. Now that's coincidence. The freaky thing now is that when I do this in my presentation, I put this one up after talking about synesthesia, and I run through a little bit of the research about synesthesia, and psychedelic drugs make you more synesthetic. Okay, so when you think about a lot of psychedelic lyrics and the clashes between them, like Marmalade Skies and all this kind of stuff. So if you're not synesthetic, psychedelic drugs make you synesthetic. I chose Debussy to go with this beer, who is synesthetic. You chose psychedelic music.
Interesting. Okay.
Well done.
It's all connected.
I feel like that's a success. Done. Mark it down, Andrew.
You get win. You win that one.
You know what? I think we've almost approached possibly about 3 hours and 30 minutes, but this has been an absolute pleasure, and I'm thinking that we possibly need to make this a regular occurrence.
Can we get four more beers in?
Yeah, we'll get at least four more beers in here. Might have to split this up into three episodes, who knows. It's been an absolute pleasure, Pete.
It has. Thank you so much for coming in.
I've not drunk so much in a podcast before. This is quite wonderful.
That's why it is the best podcast.
This is a hard job for us, Pete. It's, three podcasts a month. We do one podcast a month. I haven't seen my wife and kids in at least 6 months. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been great to have royalty on here.
I know.
I suppose we should probably wrap it up then.
I don't know how. Have you got an excellent quote? Do you want to do some plugging?
What have you got coming up? I know you have a bit of a crowdfunding campaign going on.
The crowdfunding's all finished.
Okay.
Yep.
So
I contributed.
It was that's been really interesting. My writing has now kind of gone beyond beer, and I'm now writing books that are kind of I got described the other day as a writer of literary nonfiction.
Okay, Bill Bryson also did the Shakespeare book. It's fine.
Yeah, so I'm glad that's there. I'm glad that's there, and my agent is delighted that that's there, and none of them want me to write beer books anymore.
Write more beer books.
But I still want to write beer books. So the crowdfunding thing was, I'm happy to be a writer in a broader arena than beer now, and that's where my mainstream writing is now.
Yep.
But I also still want to write beer books. But the publishers who want me to write mainstream stuff don't really want to talk to me about beer stuff. So the crowdfunding route, Unbound, are a legitimate bona fide publisher, but they raise the publication costs by crowdfunding. And this means that instead of them just guessing and spread betting on books like a mainstream publisher does, they publish books that people have been enthusiastic about raising money for. So Miracle Brew, my new book, which is out on the 1st of June, is a book that in a lot of ways is 10 years in the making. I was in a hop field in 2012 and realised that I wanted to write a book about hops. Not hops in beer, but hops. How they grow.
Yeah, yeah.
Their characteristics, why they're so important.
Yep.
And about 30 seconds after I realised that, I thought, why just hops? They're not the only ingredient in beer. We've tested some incredibly complex multi-beers tonight.
Okay.
And then I realised it needed to be about all four main ingredients of beer. So the interesting thing about crowdfunding then was because I had to kind of publicise it and give away the idea of the book before I started writing it. People like Stone and Wood in Australia, people like Charles Farram Hop Merchants got involved and said, well, can we help you with it? And it turned into a kind of global. I've now picked hops on three continents. I've been to lots of different places. And
have you grown your own yeast? Is the question.
Not willingly. I've been to the National Collection of Yeast Cultures in Norwich.
That's a proper thing.
Those guys are fucking off the pipes. They're incredible. That is my favourite bit of the book, talking to these two guys who look after the UK's collection of yeast cultures. And it became such a, it's like, okay, here's me facing beer for 20 years. Now I'm going to go around the back of beer and look at it from a completely different angle and discover so much more about it. And at the start of the process, I thought, right, I'm going to completely forget everything I think I know about malting, about barley, about hops. And I was right to do so, because everything I knew was shit. And I knew fuck all. And it's just made me fall in love with beer all over again. Those four basic ingredients, what they do, what they tell us about ourselves. is astonishing. It's really incredible. And I'm just delighted to have got, I've got a book about beer coming out again.
So when is that coming out?
The 1st of June.
1st of June, okay. So you've heard it here. It's coming out. You heard it here first, right? Because you haven't announced that anywhere else, right?
Anywhere else.
I'm so shit.
Okay, so so for the final time, thank you very much for coming on here.
Phenomenal.
It's been great. I'm so looking forward to attempting to edit this. So
just don't.
Just put it all out.
Strong beers, haven't we?
Oh, seriously, who picked all of the plus 10% beers? Anyway, so for episode 7, this has been Andrew and
Luke.
Are you Luke?
No.
And this has been Rhythm and Brewers. We'll be back next month with Renegade Brewery, I believe.
No.
Renegade?
No.
See, I'm just getting it wrong.
No, next month we're with the guys from Beer O'Clock Opinions.
We are! Of course!
We are.
I am looking forward to that. And then the month after
we're Renegade. With
Renegade Brewery. Yeah. So
I'm impressed by the forward organisation, even if...
Even if I get it completely wrong, I have no idea what's going on.
I'm looking forward to them because you know what? It's going to involve drinking beer.
Oh, it's going to be it's going to be a change of scenery for us. Okay, so this has been Rhythm and Brews for episode number 7.
Signing off.
Bye bye.